and you're back with AidWorks. Now, joining us this evening is Anthony Lowenstein. Anthony is an independent Australian journalist, documentarian and blogger who's written for the BBC, The Nation, The Guardian and Huffington Post, amongst many others. He's the author of three best-selling books, including My Israel Question, The Blogging Revolution and The Prophets of Doom, How Vulture Capitalism is Swallowing the World. And he's currently working on a new book and film on disaster capitalism. Thanks so much for joining us this evening, Anthony.
Thanks so much for having me.
Excellent. Look, now, look, I don't mean to start by tooting your horn, but like people like Jeremy Scahill, Greg Pallast and Matt Taibbi, you are one of the true investigative journalists that are out there on the scene today. Could you give our listeners some background on yourself and how you got into this line of work?
Sure. I've been a journalist for roughly 10 years, a bit longer, professional journalist for about a decade. I'm based in Sydney. I'm from Melbourne, and I initially started off working for Fairfax. I was a trainee at Fairfax for a few years, and then I've been freelance ever since, so for about a decade. And I suppose for me, Fairfax gave me a good start, but certainly from my perspective, I had a lot, I guess, a greater independent frame of mind than was often, I guess you'd say, allowed at a more corporate mainstream news organisation. So over the years, I guess I've written about a variety of issues. My first book was on Israel-Palestine, My Israel Question, which was a dissenting Jewish view on the Middle East issue, spent time over there, looked at issues such as what's happening with the Israeli occupation of Palestine, the role of the Israel lobby in shaping debate, how the media covers the issue, in my view, pretty bloody badly, then and now, with some exceptions. And I suppose for me, over the years, over a range of issues, it's always been about looking at stories or individuals who don't often get the press that they deserve. And often I say to people, younger journalists or others, that I think a lot of media, although they don't often acknowledge this, although some do, journalism is very much about insiders and outsiders. So ABC TV here in Australia has a show listeners will be aware of called Insiders. And to me, any serious journalist would be pretty upset to be on a show like that. I've never been invited, so this is not about jealousy or wishing they'd invite me. It's more, and there are some good journalists who go on that show. For the record, there definitely are. I know some of them. But the whole concept of wanting to be an insider is exactly against what journalism should be about. Journalism should be about being critical, skeptical, not being too close to governments of either persuasion or business interests or advisors or whatever that may be. So over the years, I guess I've shied away from that kind of work. And yes, it's important that I'm able now to have a weekly column in The Guardian and write elsewhere in other publications and write books and be heard. I mean, I'm not saying that an audience is not important. It is. But ultimately, to me, the best kind of writing is trying to uncover stories that people don't want you to hear. And that's, generally speaking, pissing on people who are powerful. That's how it works.
Yeah, agreed. And hopefully the rise of the internet and social media can act as that counterbalance
Absolutely.
To the corporate mainstream dominance of the media we have at the moment.
Definitely.
Okay, so moving along, now, what are you currently working on, Anthony?
So working on a couple of things. I'm doing a book that'll be out late next year in roughly a year's time with Verso, who are a British and UK publisher, on disaster capitalism. So I had a book out last year and this year called Prophets of Doom, which touched on the role of private corporations making money from misery. And this book will be similar but slightly different. So this book will look at countries like Papua New Guinea, Haiti, Afghanistan and Australia, which I did with the other book. But importantly, to add a much wider global context, I've also been spending the last few months looking at issues of UK, US and Greece. So private detention centres, the role of the far right in Greece, spending some time with Golden Dawn, who listeners may be aware is the neo-Nazi party, who are now the third biggest party in Greece, in fact. And what I'm going to argue is that the economic conditions that Greece have been put under, both from internal and external factors, almost guarantees the rise of a far right party. It doesn't have to be Golden Dawn, but some kind of interest like that. So I was spending time with them, which was pretty interesting, to say the least. And I'm also working on a film on disaster capitalism. People will see a bit of a theme. This is a film I'm working on with a New York filmmaker on Haiti, Papua New Guinea, and Afghanistan. And we've been shooting, I guess, over the last couple of years. As anyone who knows who makes films, film is a very, very slow process. So a lot of filmmaking is not actually making a film. It's trying to raise money. And that's what we've been doing. We just got some good news, in fact, literally overnight from a funding body overseas that's going to give us some money. Not, but not quite enough, and to finish the film. So we can now go back to Afghanistan at some point and continue working on the film. So essentially it's going to look at three different countries and three different examples of how the corporation in those three countries have become more powerful than the state and the problems with that. And we're going to follow personal stories in all those places to show why that's not good. And that'll hopefully be out, I'm going to say next year, fingers crossed. But with film, very hard to know, as soon as possible.
Very hard to know. Sounds like two great projects. We'll have to stay abreast of that with you and let our listeners know as they're coming up and
see if we
can't get out to the screenings and the book launches. That'd be great.
Fantastic.
Now let's move along and look, okay, you've done some great work with Australia's treatment of refugees, from the privatisation of asylum seeker internment to the turning back of boats. There are so many troubling aspects to Australia's refugee policy. What are your thoughts on our current stances and where we might be heading in the future?
Well, Australia's position on asylum seekers, from my perspective, and indeed I think a lot of people's perspectives outside of Australia, is one of deep shame. I mean, we have pretty much now for 20-odd years, and obviously the policy has not stayed exactly the same, but there's been a very strong line through both Labor and Liberal governments to punish refugees for the supposed crime of arriving here by boat to claim asylum, which is an international legal right, and a lot of people seem to forget that, including in the media. Sending refugees to Pacific Islands, essentially, where they're being tortured. I mean, just this week, listeners may have seen a report in the Fairfax Press, was in the Age and the Herald in Sydney, of serious new allegations by refugees on Nauru, alleging guards were threatening rape, were demanding women take their clothes off to get certain privileges. I mean, just unbelievable kind of allegations. Now, I have no way to know if they're entirely true. They may not be. History would suggest there's a good chance that they are. And the remarkable thing is about these kind of stories is that they appear in the press and they disappear. They're not a scandal. It's not really followed up by a lot of the other media. The government pretty much dismisses it. And it's one of the things that I researched in my book Prophets of Doom and in other work, is that there's very little oversight of the system itself. So when the government says, as they do, and Labor did this as well, centres on Nauru, Manus Island, or centres on the mainland here in Australia, there's checks and balances. That's really not entirely true at all. The contract itself that is signed between the corporation and the government, and we should also say for listeners who don't know, a lot of people don't know this pretty basic fact, that all the centres that are run by Australia, both on the mainland and offshore, are run for profit. They're not run by the Australian government. The Australian government, of course, has a presence in them. They're the ones who are doing the processing, if they do them at all, of asylum seekers very slowly. But they're run by corporations, both local corporations and multinationals. And the problem with this is that because a corporation's main aim is to turn a profit, the result is that they give very little to bad service. Service to an asylum seeker, very minimal health care, not very good training at all of the guards who are working in these centres, because the bottom line is the more money they spend on training, less money they have for profit. That's how it works. So I'm pretty dismayed by the policy here. I don't really see it changing anytime soon. You have pretty much bipartisan support in Australia for the policy. You have a vocal minority, the Greens, activists and others who routinely complain about it. You have certain elements in the press. I mean, I said I work for The Guardian. I think The Guardian, to their credit, has done some wonderful journalism in the last year and a half detailing some of the major issues and abuses in immigration detention. But I think Australia really has framed itself in a proud way from its own perspective as a nation that believes that punishing refugees is the best way forward to deter others from coming. And I think Australia likes to see itself somehow as a isolated island away from the world's greatest problems. And the fact is, you can't really do that. I mean, I'll finish on this point. Just this year, the UNHCR put out its latest report of sort of asylum movements around the world. And they found that there were, for the first time since the Second World War, over 50 million people who were looking for asylum or seeking asylum. a huge number of people. Obviously, it's been increased by the war in Syria and other conflicts, but what it shows is that Australia can't simply put its head in the sand. You can, to the extent that you can try to say, as John Howard used to say, we choose the people who come and the circumstances in which they do come. But the fact is that that's only going to last so long, because the world is moving along and refugees looking for places, and Australia should be a place of welcome, in my view, and many other people's view.
Yeah. And Australia, with such, we claim such a proud multicultural history, supposedly, but, you know, is that only for Anglo-Europeans? Is it only for people?
Yeah.
You know, it's such a horrific blight on this nation. I'd agree with you there. Okay. Now, moving on to, you know, there's so much going on in the world. I thought we'd try and sort of jump back and forth and cover some of the different issues. Now, you're Jewish, I wanted to point out, and you've written the book titled My Israeli Question. What are your thoughts on the current Israeli-Palestinian state of affairs, particularly with regards to the recent conflict in Gaza?
Well, the situation in Gaza, for those I'm sure who remember, there were roughly 2,000 Palestinians who were killed, the vast majority of whom were civilians. It really was, is there any way to describe what happened recently, was a 50-day massacre of Palestinians, and it really has nothing to do with terrorism. What I mean by that is that the justification that we were given by Israel, by Australia, by the US and other supporters of Israel was Hamas fire rockets into Israel. Israel has no choice but to go in there and demolish the rockets and destroy Hamas and therefore restore peace. But the truth of the matter is there had been for a long time a ceasefire between Hamas and Israel. And recent history shows that in fact peace is bad for business, and it's actually bad for political fortunes in Israel. What I mean by that is that you have a massive military industrial industry in Israel, and there were many articles written during the war, after the war, saying that a lot of the weapons that Israel were using were now battle-tested, meaning that other countries would be far more willing to buy those weapons afterwards to see how effective they were in the minds of arms manufacturers. Now, I'm not suggesting, just to be clear, that the war started because of an arms manufacturer. It didn't at all. What I'm arguing, though, is that the system within the Israeli political system is so skewed towards war that every 2 or 3 years there needs to be a war to maintain the fiction that Israel is fighting a war on terrorism. And the effect is that Hamas remains in power. Hamas was not defeated. In fact, because Hamas was left standing, they won by default. When you're against one of the most powerful militaries in the world, the Israeli Defense Force, and yet despite that, you still remain standing. And I think there's been countless reports from journalists who went in there, as well as Gazans themselves who were tweeting and Facebooking and others, detailing huge human rights abuses. I mean, massive human rights abuses. Huge examples of neighborhoods that were flattened without any justification whatsoever. And the reason that's being done time after time is really a systematic plan over decades from the Israeli government, and it doesn't really matter who's in power there, whether it's Likud or Labor or someone else, to say to Palestinians, you will never be able to feel comfortable in your own land. And the idea is that you somehow will want to leave or move somewhere else. And that hasn't happened. I mean, sure, there are some Palestinians who sometimes leave because life is so intolerable. But when you have an occupation that's been going on now for nearly half a century, and the complicity of many Western states, including here in Australia, of that occupation, I think really shows for many people, which is why, and Israel knows this, its legitimacy in international standing is so declined. And the recent war showed that. Yes, they still get support in the Congress, in the Australian Parliament, in the UK Parliament. But in the public, where arguably it matters more and more, support for Israel has never been lower. And that, to me, is a very positive sign that people don't want to tolerate any longer this kind of indiscriminate violence that Israel meets at every few years to Palestinians, most of whom are civilians.
And that is despite the massive media bias that we do see about the false equivalency of the coverage in the Western media.
Yeah, that's what's so interesting, isn't it? That there really is this sense that despite the fact that there is a completely disproportionate view of trying to see the Israeli perspective, and this is what I've written about quite a lot over the years, including in my book, My Israel Question, where I say Israel and Palestine are in the press every other day. However, the problem is that literally the vast, vast bulk of journalists, the Western journalists who are based there, live pretty much in the same areas in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv and mix predominantly with Israeli Jews. Now, the problem with that is that your perspective and your worldview is so incredibly skewed. Like, there are literally very, very few Western journalists who are permanently based in the West Bank, let alone in Gaza. There's actually no reason, not whatsoever, why journalists could not be and should not be based in the West Bank. They go and visit. They might go for a few days and then come back into Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. But the environment in which they operate is a very Jewish-Israeli environment. And the effect of that is that despite the fact you have thousands of journalists who are based there, their perspective is incredibly narrow. That's why it's even more interesting that in the last 10 years, since the rise of the internet, there's been such a change in people's perspective that you don't need to rely anymore on the New York Times to know what's going on. You can go straight to writers and bloggers from Palestine itself. And that happened during the Gaza War, where some of the best insights were coming from Gazans themselves who were Facebooking and tweeting what they were seeing with their own eyes.
It really is one of the most troubling questions of our time, I believe, and I do not see a solution on the horizon anytime soon, unfortunately.
No, I think in the short term that's probably true, but I think momentum is certainly shifting to a greater pressure on Israel, and that's why a lot of us support boycott, divestment and sanctions against Israel like we did against Africa, South Africa during apartheid. And that's going to have, I think, a very large effect both economically and psychologically, and it's hugely growing, especially after the recent Gaza conflict.
Now to Syria, ISIS, the US and Australia's response. What are your thoughts on ISIS and how the West has responded, or some might say overreacted, to this threat once again in the Middle East?
Well, look, ISIS as an organisation clearly, and this is not exactly a revelation, is a brutal organisation that has imposed a totalitarian style state on parts of Syria and Iraq. But the response of most of the West is exactly the wrong response. It's exactly what fundamentalists like that want, how they want the West to respond. ISIS came out of the ashes of the Iraq War after 2003. And in fact, the leader of ISIS was imprisoned and tortured by the Americans in Iraq. And apparently, before he went into jail, he was not radicalized. And after imprisoned by the US, he was. Now, clearly, the Syrian civil war escalated in the last 3.5 years. The country essentially has fallen apart. Iraq was run as a police state backed by the US and indeed by Iran. It was one of these sort of great ironies of history where the US consistently talks about the evils of Iran, but in fact the invasion of Iraq in 2003 emboldened the power of Iran in the region to the point where although the US had some influence in Iraq, Iran was a hugely massive and important player. So ISIS was able to develop really because the Iraqi army that had been funded, trained and armed by the Americans completely and utterly failed in the face of a very strong opposition, namely ISIS, who came into various cities and towns, particularly Mosul this year, which is the second biggest city in Iraq. And the Iraqi army melted away. They didn't even fight. They essentially walked away. And another irony of history is that a lot of the weapons that the Americans now fear ISIS are using come from the Americans because they stole them from the Iraqi army. Well, the money that the ISIS group now has come from looting and robbing various Iraqi towns and indeed also from Saudi and Qatari funders. So the response of the West to essentially go in there and bomb Syria, bomb Iraq, claim, as our Attorney General said last week, an absurdly embarrassing statement, that the threat from ISIS apparently is worse and more dangerous than during the Cold War. I mean, it's such an absurdly hysterical answer to suggest, wait, so when the Soviet Union and America, despite the fact that that was all, a lot of that was hysteria as well, were on the potential verge at various times as they were on nuclear war, that is less serious than a bunch of thugs in the Middle East. I mean, it's such an absurd kind of comparison. There's no doubt that ISIS are a threat. Whether they're a threat to the West, whether they're a threat to Australia or America, the intelligence services in America came out a few months ago and made a statement saying that ISIS was a threat to the Middle East, but there was no evidence to suggest that it was a threat to the US homeland. However, clearly what has now happened when the Obama administration made a decision, in my view, a very fatefully wrong one, to go back into the Middle East and launch massive airstrikes, and indeed, despite America saying they're not having ground troops, they are using huge amounts of special forces. Australia is following suit. We're playing exactly into the hands of ISIS. And until there's a realization that you're talking about fighting a war for whom? What exactly is the goal here? We keep on hearing that the goal is to support a moderate Syrian opposition. It doesn't exist. And reporters like Patrick Coburn, who write for The Independent in London, who spend a lot of time in Iraq and Syria, say it's a complete myth to believe, in fact, that you can support some kind of moderate opposition, to the point where even last night I read that in Syria at the moment, that the US is bombing areas with no coordination with this mystical Syrian opposition. The effect of that is, practically, in the last 2 weeks, that countless civilians are being killed because America is bombing indiscriminately. This is the reality of that kind of air war, and Australia is following blindly. And to me, we're likely to hugely increase the chance of terrorism on our shores here, almost by definition. And for what goal? There needs to be some resolution to Iraq and Syria. I don't for a second suggest that ISIS should simply be left to their own devices, but it needs to come from the Arab world. It needs to come from Arab countries that we don't simply support blindly because they're dictatorships. And the countries that we are backing blindly, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain and others, are some of the worst dictatorships in the world. How supporting them blindly is going to help democracy or freedom in the Middle East is anyone's guess. It won't.
And your point about the what is victory, is there going to be a point at some stage when, you know, ISIS jump on top of a pile of rubble and wave a white flag and say, this is it, it's over now? Are we going to try and kill our way to victory? There is no real winners in this situation except for the military-industrial complex, who win and make enormous profits the more bombs that are dropped. It's an amazing situation.
Absolutely, and there's no doubt that while the share prices of many of the US arms manufacturers have gone through the roof in the last few months, and again, like with the recent Gaza war, I'm not suggesting these wars are fought solely for US arms corporations. They're not. They're also fought for ideological reasons as well, but you're right, that we sort of think somehow that ISIS can be defeated militarily, and yet again, we have seen, like with Al-Qaeda in years past, these aren't really groups that you can defeat militarily. On the one hand, yes, you can kill a lot of their leaders, and America has done that with Al-Qaeda in Pakistan particularly, and Yemen and elsewhere, where they're just using drones to kill leader after leader after leader, but nothing actually has really changed on the ground. These groups still have a lot of support, and the reality is in Iraq, where we constantly hear about an Iraqi government that we now support, and we heard just the last few weeks, the Abbott government saying, yes, the Iraqi government has requested our support, as if somehow the Iraqi government is an independent government. It's basically a US client state and an Iranian client state. I mean, they're acting for their own reasons, as they, you know, have the right to do. But you're right, this idea that declaring victory, we really are led, whether it's Abbott or Bishop or Obama, by a set of adolescent children who are probably given apocalyptic warnings by their military advisors to sort of say, the way to deal with any problem is to use military first and ask questions second. You'd think after the last 10 years, after Iraq and Afghanistan, Libya and elsewhere, that we'd think twice. But Abbott is so desperate to be seen as this kind of macho leader in the world. And frankly, not surprisingly, his domestic supporters, in fact, increased in the last month, despite the fact that he has many other problems, including, you know, getting a budget through Parliament. So in a cynical way, you could say he's actually doing it for reasons that are pretty transparent.
Now, with Australia spending millions and dedicating so many resources to this perceived threat that is ISIS, however, we're doing very little, if anything, to combat the spread of Ebola. As far as danger to the international community and the way of life internationally, I would place Ebola a lot higher on the scale than ISIS. This week, the WHO reported that 1 million people could be infected with Ebola by the end of the year. And just today, we've seen the first case of the virus appear in the US. What are your thoughts on the rise and spread of Ebola and the international response or lack of response to it?
Well, look, Ebola really, I think, is symptomatic of how, in a very cynical sense, the West sees the world. And let's say it very bluntly here. The fact of the matter is that 99% of victims of Ebola are black in countries that the West doesn't really care about. This is the brutal reality of this situation. Now, if suddenly there was an Ebola outbreak in England or Australia or America, you'd be rest assured, of course, the response would be very different. This is clearly about race. Ebola is a hugely destructive disease. I'm understanding that there are a number of vaccines or at least medical trials that are being rushed forward to try to find some kind of solution for what you say is a potential cataclysmic reality, in particularly West Africa. I'm also really worried about the fact that the Obama administration's response in the last month or so has been to send 3,000 US troops to Liberia to assist in Ebola management. Now, on the one hand, I haven't got an issue with the West assisting with their great amount of resources to reduce the Ebola outbreak. However, we can't see the US role in Africa simply as being benign. In fact, one of the things that's very clear is this is a wonderful way from their perspective to get influence militarily in a region and a continent that they feel like they're losing to China. This has been one of the great new Cold War battles of the last 10 years. It haven't got a lot of press, but China and America are competing for resources and influence in Africa. Ebola comes along. It's a perfect opportunity, and the Liberian government, admittedly, were desperate for help. So I'm not suggesting that they are simply being blindsided, but to send US troops to try to assist in this process, to militarize aid yet again, which is what the US has done so disastrously elsewhere, to me is a really big concern. And I guess ultimately I would say that the Ebola virus, I don't know exactly if we even know particularly where it started or where it came from. I know there's been some research about that, but I'm not entirely sure of all the facts of that on top of my head. But I guess I'm concerned with the fact that the international response has been so incredibly slow, which is how it often is, frankly, when it comes to Africa anyway. I mean, if you ask the average person what they know about Africa based on the media coverage, what do you reckon the answer's going to be? It's pretty much zero. The ABC has got one person, for example, based in Africa. Fairfax has nobody. News Limited's got nobody. I'm talking about from Australia. Africa is this kind of black mass that is routinely ignored unless something crazy happens like some civil war or a famine or Ebola. And I think it really goes to the heart of why, from my perspective, there needs to be far greater interest in a part of the world that clearly has a lot of impact on all of us, but also is just a place that deserves humanity, not least because of the Western history of colonialism in that region. I mean, we owe a debt, a huge debt, to me, to those countries, considering what we did to them in decades past, and still do.
Yeah, a massive point. Unfortunately, we're running out of time, Anthony, so we're going to have to wind it up there. Some really brilliant insights to such a wide variety of topics. Really appreciate you spending some time with us this evening and enlightening some of our viewers with some of your ideas and thoughts there.
No, my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.
Okay, Anthony, and we will talk to you soon.
Thank you. Cheers.